but it was unnecessary and only served to rather alarm the two poor invalids, Hudson and Blackborough. And though they were spared the fate of being dramatically swept off the spit, the island did its best to flood them anyway. They discovered early in July that water had filtered up through the rocks forming the floor of the hut. It was difficult to tell exactly where it came from, but apparently it was the result of natural drainage running down under their foundation. When they first became aware of it, they tried to make a drain through one of the side walls, but this was not noticeably effective, and once the condition had begun, it seemed to get progressively worse. They soon found that to avoid being flooded away, they had to dig a hole about 2 feet deep at the lowest spot inside the hut. This immediately filled with water, and they were thus able to bail it out. The first time, they removed more than 70 gallons. Thereafter, they had to be constantly alert whenever the weather was warm or wet. James recorded on July the 26th, "About midnight, awakened by pleas of men that water in hut was up to stones. Only thing to do, to get up and bail, or else get soaked. Hurley, McElroy, Wild, and Self rose and got out 50 gallons. About the same amount had to be taken out at 5 a.m., and yet more before breakfast." Not only was it an irksome task, but the water itself was a nauseating liquid, soupy with penguin guano. As luck would have it, the sump hole from which they bailed was located directly in front of the cooking stove. Over the months, the interior of the hut had become filthy to the point of squalor. Indeed, they usually referred to it as the sty or the snuggery. When they could, they brought in fresh stones to cover the floor, but a great deal of the time, the only available stones outside were frozen in place. In the subterranean gloom inside the place, small pieces of food had dropped unnoticed onto the floor, and now, with a combination of water and heat, the food began to rot, contributing yet one more disagreeable odour. Near the end of July, the abscess on Hudson's buttock had grown to the size of a football. McElroy disliked the idea of opening it because of the risk of infection, but Hudson was in such severe pain that it had to be done. McElroy finally performed the operation without an anaesthetic, and removed more than 2 pints of foul-smelling liquid. "It is hard to realize one's position here," Macklin wrote, "living in a smoky, dirty, ramshackle little hut with only just sufficient room to cram us all in, drinking out of a common pot, and laying in close proximity to a man with a large discharging abscess. A horrible existence, but yet we are pretty happy." And later, "I've given Blackborough my piece of reindeer skin, which I brought from Ocean Camp. His bag is rottener than mine, poor chap. He gets very little chance of getting out of it." As July drew to a close, the feeling of anxiety, so long suppressed, became increasingly difficult to fight back. Hurley wrote on the 30th, "Today seems to be particularly monotonous, and the wild magnificence of the precipitous cliffs that limit us to the circumscribed confines of Cape Wild loom through the mist like prison walls, sinister and inaccessible. If there were only some duties, useful or otherwise, to be performed, the burden of time would be more pleasant. At present, our sole exercise is to promenade up and down the 80 yards of the spit, or climb to the lookout and scan the misty skyline for a mast. We look forward anxiously to the forthcoming month, when relief is anticipated. One grows weary of continually estimating the days from the Caird's departure to the hoped-for arrival of the relief ship." In varying degrees, it was the same with all of them. In their interminable discussions of when and how they might be rescued, there had been one possibility that was rarely mentioned: the loss of the Caird. It was considered somehow bad luck even to discuss it, and any man who brought it up was looked upon as speaking out of turn and in bad taste, almost as if he'd sullied something that was sacred. And though they were still hesitant to suggest openly that the Caird could be lost, they could no longer avoid admitting, at least tacitly, that something, quite possibly, might have happened. Shackleton had been gone for 99 days, and there was a kind of creeping awareness that they might be watching for something that would never come. If so, Macklin finally conceded in his diary on July the 31st, it means a journey in the Stancomb Wills to Deception Island. This will be an arduous journey, but I hope I will be picked one of the party if it comes to this. Still, there was the deadline they had set for themselves, the middle of August. But time seemed almost to come to a standstill. August the 1st was the anniversary of the day, 2 years before, when the Endurance had sailed from London, and 1 year before, when she had sustained her first serious pressure. Hurley summed it up. "The memories of everything up to now," he wrote, "flit through our minds as a chaotic, confused nightmare. The past 12 months appear to have passed speedily enough, and though we've been dwelling here in a life of security for nearly 4 months, this latter period seems longer than the preceding balance of the year. This doubtless is occasioned by our counting the days, and the daily expectations of deferred relief, as well as our having no work to perform. The watching day by day, and the anxiety for the safety of our comrades of the Caird, lay a holding hand on the already retarded passage of time." Each day, he spent a little longer atop the lookout bluff, searching for a sign of the relief ship. On August the 3rd, Ord Lees wrote, "Still surrounded by close pack. We're pretty short of both fuel and meat, but no one seems to care very much. Sir Ernest's non-return is now openly discussed. No one likes to think that he could possibly have failed to reach South Georgia, but it is significant of the current of thoughts that Wilde has given orders that every scrap of cord and wool and all nails are to be carefully kept, in view of the possibility of our having to make a boat journey to Deception Island." For such a journey, they were desperately short of equipment. The only sail remaining was the Will's ridiculous little jib, so they would have to contrive some sort of mainsail out of sewn-together pieces of the rotten tent cloths. There was not even a mast from which it might be hoisted. The mast from the Wills had been taken to make a mizzenmast for the Caird, and the dockers had been sacrificed to strengthen the Caird's keel. But something probably could be done with the 5 oars they still had. And so it went. August the 4th. James. Monotony of existence extreme. August the 5th. Hurley. Sitting like an invalid in one sleeping bag, and rereading the same few books. August the 6th, Hurley. It will be ideal weather for the ship to arrive. August the 7th, Macklin. Hudson was up and out for a little while today. He was very groggy, and on attempting to wave his hand to McElroy, he fell on his back. August the 8th, Ord Lees. We had to bail out 4 times, rather more than usual. August the 9th, Green Street. Wordy discovered an old newspaper, or part of one, date September 14th, 1914, which is being eagerly read and reread by all. August the 10th, Macklin. I've been watching the snow petrels. They're wonderful little birds. Sometimes they get caught by a breaker and dashed on the shore, but they soon recover and go off again to their fishing. August the 11th, Ord Lees. Marston was out at 5 a.m., but the coast was clear. August the 12th, Macklin. I cannot help worrying about my people at home. If only I could be sure that they had got news, I should not mind, but I know how they will worry. August the 13th, James. Beginning to look anxiously for the ship. This is about the time. August the 14th, James. We've been eating seaweed lately, boiled. The taste is peculiar, but anything for a change. August the 15th, Ord Lees. It snowed at intervals during the day. August the 16th, Macklin. Eagerly on the lookout for the relief ship, and most of us go up the hill and eagerly scan the horizon for any sign of her. Some of the party have quite given up all hope of her coming. August the 17th, Hurley. The ice has put in a reappearance. August the 18th, Green Street. Both bays full of pack, and heavy pack, as far as the eye can see. August the 19th, Ord Lees. There is no good in deceiving ourselves any longer. Part 6, Chapter 1. Monday, April 24th. We took goodbye with our companions and set sail on our 870 miles to South Georgia for assistance at 12:30, and at 2 p.m. we came to a stream of ice which we managed to get through in about an hour. Then we were in the open sea, wet through but happy through it all. McNeish's Log. Monday, 24th, April. Wild camp for rating chronometer, 192/262. Took departure in James Caird at 12:30 p.m. Steered north-northeast 8 miles, then east 1 mile, to a break in the stream ice, here running east and west. Wind to 4 p.m, west-northwest 6, approximately 30 miles per hour. Worsley's Log. The little group of dark figures, waving goodbye, was silhouetted against the white snow, and they made a pathetic picture from the Caird as she lifted to the increasing swell. Worsley held her on a northerly course, and Shackleton stood beside him, alternately peering ahead at the approaching ice, and turning again to look at the men he was leaving behind. It was only a short time, it seemed, until they were no longer discernible. Before long, the whole of Elephant Island widened out astern, its great craggy headlands and glacier walls catching the sun. Off to the right, tiny Cornwallis Island, rising steeply out of the sea, came into view from behind Cape Valentine, and a little while later the snowy peaks of Clarence Island could be seen, delicately half-hidden by the violet-tinted mists. In the water, an occasional seal or a small flock of penguins swam past, looking curiously at this strange creature that was moving across the surface of the sea. It was just 2 o'clock when the Caird reached the ice, which proved to be a thick line of ancient floes that had been broken and melted into a myriad of different shapes. They rose to the long westerly swell in stately cadence, producing a hoarse, rustling noise. Worsley swung the boat east, parallel with the ice, to search for the opening that he and Shackleton had seen from the spit earlier in the day. It took them almost an hour to reach it, and they discovered that it was nearly clogged with floe fragments and patches of brash ice. Nevertheless, Worsley brought the Caird's bow round, and they started through. Almost at once, the boat was dwarfed by weird shapes of ice, some of them twice the height of the mast. They swayed and bowed in the lazy movement of the sea. Above the water, they were pure snowy white. Beneath it, they shaded into ever-deepening blue. Worsley tried to steer the boat safely amongst the lumps, but several times, turning to avoid one fragment, they bumped into another, and Shackleton decided they had better row. The sails were dropped, and the men carefully crawled up onto the decking and put out their oars. Rowing was extremely awkward, sitting as they were flush with the oarlocks. Fortunately, the wind died down. Shackleton had taken over the helm, and he urged the rowers on. It was after 4 o'clock, and the light was beginning to fail. However, after almost an hour, the ice began to thin out, and they soon came to the northern edge of the pack, then emerged once more into the open sea. The rowers happily scrambled back inside the cockpit, and everyone was enormously relieved. The wind had gradually swung around to the southeast, the perfect direction for driving them north. Shackleton ordered the sails set, and after they were up, he sent Crean, McNeish, Vincent, and McCarthy forward to get some sleep, saying that he and Worsley would stay on duty throughout the night to watch for ice.